Good morning. I'm going to talk this morning, maybe finish up the talk that I started 2 months ago. We'll see how far I get through it. It's on the four elements of a bodhisattva's social relations. And last, there are four of these elements. They are giving, kind speech, helpful conduct, and cooperation. Last time I got through giving, and so we'll see if I get through the others today. A little bit of background on the essay. I'm talking about an essay that was written by A.H. Dogen in, 1238 maybe. Maybe 1237. He wrote this originally for lay followers. He did not include this essay when he first put together all of his essays in what's called the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. He didn't include this one because by the time he got to the end of his life and he was compiling his set of essays, he compiled it for monks. And so he left this one out because it was aimed at lay people. Eventually, in later compilations of the True Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, this was also this was included. When I talked about this last time, I talked about giving, but I framed the whole idea of all of these four elements as being rooted in emptiness. It's a little strange to think of social relationships being rooted in emptiness, but that is, I think, the thrust of the essay. Let me talk a little bit about giving so that that people are caught up who weren't here last time. Giving is dana, is the Sanskrit word for it. It means giving, it means generosity. It is the first of the six perfections. It is, Dogen spends a lot of time in his writings about giving. And if indeed everything is empty and there nothing has a discrete self, independent self, then the idea of giving is pretty easy to understand because we are simply always giving. It's our nature to be give. It's our nature to be connected totally with the rest of the world, whether it's at a biological level and taking in air, taking in water, giving out carbon dioxide, giving out water, taking in food, giving out compost. It's a nature of existence to give. Generosity is in our nature. So, I'm going to go on to kind speech. And I will read a little bit, and then I'll talk about it. The second of the four elements, kind speech. Let me back up a little bit. The book that I, the translation I used is by a couple of people, Nishijima and Cross, and they describe, translate bodhisattva as a person who is pursuing the Buddhist truth, Oftentimes, bodhisattva is defined as someone who is a Buddha, but chooses not to cross over into nirvana, but turns back, stays in the world, and devotes his or her energy to freeing all beings. I like this definition better because I don't think of myself as a Buddha who has almost reached nirvana and has decided to come back and help free all beings. I just don't, I kind of don't think I've attained that at some level. And so this definition I like better because it says a bodhisattva is a person who is pursuing the Buddhist truth. I can relate to that better than I can to having just missed nirvana by a second. The Buddha said, as Steve Hagen said last week, the Buddha said, I teach... I don't know if Steve got the translation right. I'm going to translate it the way I've always heard it. The Buddha said, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. Suffering and the end of suffering. And in the Four Noble Truths, the first is suffering, the second is cessation, the second is a cause, and the third is cessation, and the fourth is the path. Suffering and... if that's the Buddhist truth, and sometimes truth is translated as way, the Buddhist way. And the Buddhist way, quite simply, in a simple form, is not seeking, not grasping, not adding, not subtracting. The Buddhist truth, the Buddhist way. Not seeking, not grasping, not adding, not subtracting. Simply being with things as it is. That's the Buddhist way. So a bodhisattva is a person who is pursuing, not seeking, not grasping, not adding, not subtracting. Now, we have a hard time with that. I mean, our nature is to grasp, is to seek, is to get more, is to build up our ego. But the pursuit of that path is what a bodhisattva does. So, kind speech. I was trying to get to kind speech. Here is a little. It's not a very long essay. Here's a quote from it about kind speech. Kind speech means, when meeting living beings, first of all to feel compassion for them and to offer caring and loving words. Broadly, it is there being no rude or bad words. In secular societies, there are polite customs of asking others if they are well. In Buddhism, there are the words, take good care of yourself. And there is the disciple's greeting, how are you? Speaking with a feeling of compassion for living beings as if they were babies is kind speech. Kind speech here, the Sanskrit is praya akhyana. And it means, in basically, loving words. And it is distinct from, or different than, we have the Eight Noble Truths, which is the fourth, the Eightfold Path, which is the fourth noble truth. We have right speech there, or perfect speech, or upright speech, or beneficial speech. That Sanskrit word is samyag vacha. They're different. One is, or the right speech in the Eightfold Noble Path is avoidance of lying, perfect speech, avoidance of slandering, avoidance of gossip. It is speaking in a way that is in alignment with moral precepts. This kind speech is speaking as if you're speaking to a baby. It's loving words. It's really quite different. But when I say speaking as if speaking to a baby, it doesn't mean speaking to you, in words that are you know, childish, and it means coming from the heart as if you have a baby in front of you, a little child, and speaking to others with that sense is kind speech. I said earlier that I think all of these are elements are grounded in emptiness, and I think this one is also, because compassion is. Milarepa, who is a Tibetan master, once said, "The notion of emptiness generates compassion." The notion of emptiness generates compassion. It's a little hard sometimes for, particularly us Americans, to get our minds around this sense of emptiness generating compassion. But the flip side of emptiness in Buddhism, if we don't have any discrete self that we can put that is there that we can actually grasp onto, the flip side of it is that we are totally interpenetrated by the universe, and we totally interpenetrate the universe. We aren't different than the universe. And when you go there, you have a sense, or maybe can see a crack that allows you, me, to recognize that we are connected to everything. And that's how emptiness generates compassion. When you look into the face of another person, you're looking in your own face. You can't really separate out. When you're looking at the lake, you're looking at your own face. At a fundamental level, we are all interconnected. And hence, that is how emptiness generates compassion. I love this line in here. He says, Buddhism, there are the words, take good care of yourself. So it's a common greeting, take good care of yourself. A translation of that is value yourself highly. Buddhist greeting, value yourself highly. Take good care of yourself. Take care. Take care. And that's kind speech. But it also speaks to the idea that taking care of yourself is taking care of the universe. And it manifests through kind speech. When you sit zazen, if you take care of yourself sitting zazen, you're taking care of the universe. And again, what does taking care mean when you're sitting zazen? The Buddhist way is non-seeking, non-grasping. So taking care to settle into that is taking care of the universe. Value yourself highly. And move out of that space. He goes on and he says, while the present body and life exist, we should enjoy kind speech, and we will not regress or deviate through many ages and many lives. Whether in defeating adversaries or in promoting harmony among gentle folk, kind speech is fundamental. To hear kind speech spoken to us directly makes the face happy and the mind joyful. To hear kind speech indirectly etches an impression in the heart and in the soul. Remember, kind speech arises from a loving mind, and the seed of a loving mind is compassion. The first line, while the present body and life exist, we should enjoy kind speech. There's a line from another essay by Dogen called The Universal Recommendations for Zazen. And in it he says, you have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. Pivotal opportunity of human form. What do we do with that? We have human consciousness. And again, from a perspective of emptiness and dependent core rising, our human consciousness is no different than a rock. And yet we have it. We have it. What do we do with it? He speaks here about whether in defeating adversaries or in promoting harmony among gentlefolk, kind speech is fundamental. And he actually spends a good deal of time towards the end on kind of politics. But it makes me think of people who have used kind speech in the political realm. And I think President Obama is one, but I think Martin Luther King is another. I think Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela. People who were in the crucible of political conflict who would use kind speech in speaking to their adversaries. I have a friend who's a Republican. And his father is, well, my friend would say he's purple. He's not red or blue. He votes for the person. His father, on the other hand, is a Republican. And his grandfather is a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. And we're talking about Obama, which my purple friend voted for him. But interestingly, he said his father voted for him because his father is a really kind of financial guy, and he likes the way, I mean, he likes Obama's intelligence. But he said his grandfather even voted for Obama because in his grandfather's mind, he's bringing civility back into the public sphere. Well, that's kind of interesting. That's kind of interesting. But a kind speech, I think, is something that we miss in the public sphere. I'm going to go off on a little tangent here because this is not a political speech, but. Do a little bit more on Obama. I had read recently, or actually quite a while ago, when Obama was elected. I think it was when he was elected. It might have been when he was nominated for the office. Alice Walker, who is a writer, well-known writer, African-American woman, wrote a piece or an essay. It was, in essence, a letter to Obama. And I want to read a couple of paragraphs from that. I think it has to do with right speech, and I also think it has to do with that idea of take good care of yourself. Value yourself highly. She says, "Dear Brother Obama," and she goes on about having a black man elected president is quite significant. And then he said, I would advise you to remember that you did not create the disaster that the world is experiencing, and you alone are not responsible for bringing the world back to balance. A primary responsibility that you do have, however, is to cultivate happiness in your own life, to make a schedule that permits sufficient time of rest and play. I would further advise you not to take on other people's enemies. Most damages that others do to us is out of fear, humiliation, and pain. Those feelings occur in all of us, not just in those of us who profess a certain religious or racial devotion. We must learn actually not to have enemies, but only confused adversaries who are ourselves in disguise. It is understood by all that you are Commander-in-Chief of the United States and are sworn to protect our beloved country. This we understand completely. However, And she goes on to quote her mother. But we must learn to actually have, actually not to have enemies, but only confused adversaries who are ourselves in disguise. Again, that relates to, in my mind, in terms of right speech, speaking to others as if they were a baby. Speaking to others as if they were ourselves in disguise, another manifestation of ourselves. How do we do that in our day-to-day life? I think it begins by valuing ourselves highly. As I read before, he says, to hear kind speech indirectly etches an impression in the heart. The word actually is liver, but translating it for Americans or for English speaking folk, it's usually translated mind. And in, so to hear kind speech indirectly etches an impression in the heart, liver, and in the soul. Remember, kind speech arises from a loving mind, and the seed of a loving mind is compassion. And here, the translators talk about how they're using mind, and I think it's significant. In the second use of mind, a loving mind, they write, shin means not only mind, but also heart. In fact, the Chinese character is originally a pictograph of a heart. In this translation, heart, mind, has almost always been translated as mind, but the intended meaning is the subjective side of the whole human state. Not only intellectual consciousness. The intended meaning is the subjective side of the whole human state, not only intellectual consciousness. So here we have mind, liver, the whole subjective state of human consciousness. So if we think about, if you think about your mind, my mind, not as, you know, in here, but maybe in the liver, and maybe in the bladder, and maybe in the spleen, and maybe in our entire consciousness, everything we experience. If we think of the mind as that, as opposed to our intellectual functioning, we become, I think, fuller human beings. And kind speech in that regard is from one person, from one mind to another, kind speech is providing a balm for the other. A balm for their mind, for their subjective consciousness. That kind speech is a transmission from mind to mind of love and compassion. So, kind speech as the second element of social, bodhisattva social relations. The next one is helpful action or helpful conduct. And let me read a quote on that. Find page 28. Helpful conduct means utilizing skillful means to benefit living beings, high or low. For example, by looking into the distant and near future and employing expedient methods to benefit them. People have taken pity on stricken turtles and taken care of sick sparrows. When they saw the stricken turtle and the sick sparrow, they did not seek any reward from the turtle and the sparrow. They were motivated solely by helpful conduct itself. Stupid people think that if we put the benefit of others first, our own benefit will be eliminated. And again, this is helpful conduct. Sometimes it's called useful means. It is different again than right conduct of the Eightfold Path, which is perfect, upright, beneficial conduct, actions that avoid conflict with moral guidelines. This is different. We're not talking about good behavior here. We're talking about actions, conduct that's helpful to others. And in this I'm going to back up a step to giving. When I talked about giving, there are two kinds of giving. One are material goods and one is the Dharma. And the exchange actually was from monks to lay people. But those are the two types of giving that are identified in Buddhist literature. And so there are four basic material things that human beings need: shelter, food, medicine, and clothing. And the Buddha would say, until people have those four, forget about giving the Dharma. Here, when we talk about right conduct, one way to think about it is conduct that will help others on the way. Conduct that will help others find, get to, encourage, nurture a non-seeking, non-grasping mind. That's a dharmic way of viewing helpful conduct. And looking forward. As a parent, if you're a parent, you don't necessarily, or a teacher, you don't necessarily just deal with what the person is presenting, but if you can step back and provide some perspective about how to help them take the next step to where they need to go. The next step here is to find peace and equanimity, a non-seeking, non-grasping mind. That would be helpful conduct. But if someone is lacking an essential for their survival, food, shelter, clothing, then you might provide that. That would be helpful conduct. Not necessarily in a dharmic way, but in a dharmic way. Helpful conduct can be thought, in those two realms. Something that is helpful to someone in a material way, and something that's helpful to someone in a dharmic way to help them find peace and equanimity, to help them on the way. And I think, you know, it can get more involved than that. You know, we have lots of relationships. We have work relationships. We have family relationships. And there's a lot going on. And my co-office worker may not be interested in my helping them get to a peaceful mind. That may not be on their agenda. And there are all sorts of psychological ways we can help people, but that's not what Dogen is talking about. Dogen is talking about a helpful conduct in a dharmic way and also in a material way.
He has a little sentence in here about people have taken pity on stricken turtles and taken care of six sparrows. When they saw the stricken turtle and the sick sparrow, they did not seek any reward from the turtle and sparrow. They were motivated solely by helpful conduct itself. These refer to two stories. One is that a man called Koyu saved a turtle in distress, and as a result of this good act, he later became a governor of a district in the state of... And another chronicle says that a 9-year-old boy called Yoho took care of an injured bird, and as a result of this good act, his descendants ascended to 3 top positions in the Chinese government. Huh? Don't step on any worms. I'll read one more little piece.
If you step on a worm, you can become the garbage man.
This is also a helpful conduct. The man of the past who bound his hair 3 times in the course of 1 bath and who spat out his food 3 times in the course of 1 meal solely had a mind to help others. I'll get to that in a minute. There was never a question that he might not teach them just because they were the people of a foreign land. So we should benefit friends and foes equally, and we should benefit ourselves and others alike. And this is a story of a fellow in, I think, the Tang Dynasty, who was he was a king, and he told his son, "If 3 guests came while I was taking a bath, I would bind my hair 3 times to meet them. And if 3 guests came while I was eating, I would stop eating 3 times to meet them." He was saying, basically, if guests came seeking something from me as the king, and I was in my bath, I would get up, and I would dry off, and I'd put my robe on, and I'd go and greet them. And I'd get back into my bath, and if somebody else came, I would get up, I would dry off, I would go out and greet them. Likewise, in a meal. And one of the things that I, it's a little practice I do, and find it useful. When I'm at work, I can really get caught up in my work. I mean, I really can kind of get, caught. I mean, people kind of give me wide berth because I get so caught up in my work. It's gotten to the point where I actually have to buy, to get people to come in to my space, I have to, like, put out little chocolate-covered almonds. It kind of gets them in. So I'm giving a double message, right? I mean, kind of try get them in with chocolates. Meanwhile, I'm so intense in my work. And I don't think the point being is the chocolates is a way to try to relate to my coworkers or get my coworkers into my sphere, even though the way I work, it's people don't want to step in there. So I've taken to another practice. This is the alternative to chocolate-covered almonds. And that is, and I do have people. Some people come in, and they. What I will do is, I will, turn away from my computer, my laptop. My laptop faces outside, so I'll turn away from my computer, and I will consciously take 3 breaths while I'm watching them. Maybe tomorrow I'll watch them as if they were a baby. But simply settle in to that room with that person, and then space gets created. Space gets created to, if they want to tell me about this one coworker who lives on Loring Park, and she knows I'm into birds, and if she's seen something that she thinks is kind of special, like a heron or something, she'll come in and she'll tell me. And
if I do this practice, rather than my reaction being one of, geez, you know what, I really don't want to hear your bird stories. I have to get this paper out or this, I have to prepare for this meeting. Rather than that being my reaction, if I open up, my reaction can be one of curiosity and pleasure. Because when I'm working the way I work, now this king was taking a bath, right? Or he's having a dinner. He wasn't kind of at the computer doing it. But I think it's the same openness to others. If someone comes seeking, if someone comes asking, to be willing to get out of the bathtub, dry off, put on your robe, and visit with them. We have one more. I'm going to try to finish this up so it doesn't, this talk doesn't drag on for a third time. So we have giving, right speech or kind speech, and helpful conduct. And the fourth one is cooperation or identity action. The Sanskrit is samana artatha, and it is sometimes translated as identity of purpose or sharing the same aim. Sharing the same aim. Or colloquially, it can also mean in a common usage. It could also mean being in the same boat. A quote. Cooperation means not being contrary. It is not being contrary to oneself and not being contrary to others. And again, the relationship here to emptiness and dependent co-origination is that there is nothing that's contrary. There is nothing that's other. It is almost impossible. It is impossible at some level to be contrary. And again, if you think of a work situation or a familial situation or organizational situation, you will often find yourselves in conflict with or in holding a contrary position. But I think what this is talking about is if you actually step back into big mind, it's all the same. It's kind of like two teams playing a game. It's the game. You know, and there may be a winner and a loser, but it's the game that's at work here. Goes on and says, Kanshi says, and Kanshi is a Taoist text, the sea does not refuse water. Therefore it is able to realize its greatness. Mountains do not refuse earth. Therefore they are able to realize their height. Enlightened rulers do not hate people. Therefore, they are able to realize a large following. Remember, and this is where Dogen, this is kind of what I love about Dogen, he goes off on a riff here. Remember, the sea not refusing water is cooperation. Remember also that water has the virtue of not refusing the sea. For this reason, it is possible for water to come together to form the sea and for the earth to pile up to form mountains. We can think to ourselves that because the sea does not refuse the sea, it realizes the sea and realizes greatness. And because mountains do not refuse mountains, they realize mountains and realize height. Because enlightened rulers do not hate people, they realize a large following. A large following means a nation.
As many of you know, I take a lot of comfort in and a lot of my understanding about life from the natural world. And that's part of the reason I groove when Dogen goes off on a riff like this. I'm kind of right there with him. But it also talks to me of evolution. It talks to me about consciousness in the world. Mountains, seas, and consciousness. They realize themselves. We are so into our sense of ourselves, our egos, that we think our consciousness is somehow different than a mountain or a lake. It's not. It is of. It is part of. It is. It realizes itself in the mountain and the lake, and the lake and mountain realize themselves in our human consciousness. Another poet, Antonio Machado, put it this way. Again, I play my part, bound up with water, yet water in the living rock of my heart. Again, I play my part, bound up with water, yet water in the living rock of my heart. We may not know it, but we're cooperating in the whole grand affair. We can't not cooperate in the unfolding of the universe with our living rocks, with our living hearts, with our livers, our minds, our consciousness. We are part of the big unfolding. And finally, he ends this essay, "Thus the truth of cooperation exists both for enlightened rulers and for ignorant people. And this is why cooperation is the conduct and the vow of a bodhisattva. We should face all things only with gentle faces." We should face all things only with gentle faces. So in this essay, and it's an unusual essay for Dogen, he's talking to lay people, and he's talking in a way that is a little bit unusual about social relations, about kind of the day-to-day affairs of getting along in community and family. And he identifies these three: giving, kind speech, helpful conduct, and cooperation. But he talks about them in a way that is not psychological. It's not political. It's tying our conduct to who we really are. It's in an existential and mystical way. These behaviors, these elements, are part and parcel of who we are. And I think they all are rooted in emptiness. So our social relations are emptied in the fact that are rooted in the fact that we don't have a discrete self, and that's kind of a little bit of a paradox. Who's doing the relating? And I think that as I was preparing this, what I settled on is it's all about taking care of yourself. Valuing yourself highly, because we are all part of this. And I know it's hard sometimes for us to get our minds around that. If one values oneself highly, one is valuing the world highly, valuing the universe, valuing all things highly. And taking good care of yourself means taking good care of the moment, taking good care of what you're experiencing and who you're with. And whether you're sitting zazen, take good care of yourself. Whether you're eating your breakfast, take good care of yourself. Whether you're driving down the highway, take good care of yourself. And then you're taking good care of the universe. So that is it for the talk. Are there any questions or comments? Thoughts?
I guess I have kind of a definition thing. It's what you just read about what Dovin was saying, that he doesn't seem to make a distinction between consciousness and the natural unfolding of the nature, like the piling of mountains and water returning to the sea. Is that the right understanding of Dovin? And are there other examples of that? I mean, because consciousness to me denotes some sort of a rational process that only that human beings do, and the natural the unfolding of things kind of denotes a way, the flow of everything. Do you think he makes a distinction? Is there any other examples of that in writing and thinking?
Well, I think. From Dogen's point of view, and so to some extent, obviously it's my talk, but from Dogen's point of view, he's a radical non-dualist. Rivals Nagarjuna in terms of his radicalism. And that radical non-dualism doesn't allow a space for human consciousness to be any different than the lake, the mountain, the river. There's no space for that. It's a conception and confection that we have as human beings, that somehow our consciousness is somehow different than. Now, what you were probably picking up on a little bit, I'm a Darwinian. And when I think about it from that perspective, how can human consciousness be anything separate from everything else? I mean, human consciousness doesn't exist without everything supporting it and everything that has been supporting it for the last several billions of years. And we, as human beings, we try to kind of somehow think that, you know, that what's going on here is in consciousness, and you're thinking of it as rational, and it can be the subject, you know, the whole subjective experience of a human being, which is rational and non-rational, includes the liver and spleen as well as our brain. But we try to draw a circle around that or a box around it and say human consciousness is separate. It is distinct. It has powers that the rest of the natural world, the rest of the world doesn't. But it is the natural world. It is. I mean, it's not separate from. And so that's from sort of a, if you will, an evolutionary point of view. I think of it that way, but Dogen would think of it from that radical non-dualistic point of view. Is there's no separation, and it's our conception that separates out human consciousness. Of course, we have to work with our own human consciousness. I mean, there is the paradox there, but he would come at it from a radical non-dualistic point of view. And I have different experiences than Dogen. So I think of it in different ways, too. Is that at all helpful?
No, it's great.
Okay. Good. Thanks. Other questions or thoughts?
I just want to thank you for being here. I didn't know if I was going to be here this morning, and it was 9:25, and you all sleep. I really did. And then I was like, no, know what, if I don't go, I really just have this gut feeling I'm going to miss a good talk. And then it was 25 to 10, I'm like, what? Okay, are you getting out of bed, Paul? Are you going out? So I got here, and I just want to thank you. Just lots of really good things and images to play around with in my head. I love that baby example, and I think it's so true, because either when somebody talks to you that way, it feels so good. Mm-hmm. And then when you talk to another human being that way, you just see it all over their faces. So thank you for the images and the wonderful thoughts today.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming.
Got my torn jeans on.
I tell you, a talk without people in the room is a whole different thing.